Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. Artist Titus Kaphar just won the Rappaport Prize from the De Cordova Sculpture Park and Museum, which honors a contemporary artist with strong connections to New England and a proven record of achievement. Kaphar alters the way we see history with his provocative paintings, sculptures, and drawings and installations. Take his portrait of President Thomas Jefferson. Kaphar painted Jefferson in the traditional neoclassical style, but then attached Jefferson's painting to the corner of a portrait of Sally Hemings, the enslaved girl Jefferson owned. Jefferson's painting dangles from the corner of the frame, revealing half of Hemings's portrait, showing her nude. Jefferson's gaze is pronounced and bold, and he's visibly much older than Hemings, reflecting the cruel power dynamic between master and enslaved person. That work is now at the National Portrait Gallery in D.C., and Kaphar's work has also been acquired by the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, Yale University, and he's currently working on a new collection slated to open at Mass MoCA early next year. Titus Kaphar joins me now from New Haven. Hello, Titus.
How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. So for our listeners who may be learning about you for the first time, I wonder if you could tell us an anecdote that I think really encapsulates the ethos of your work. You tell the story of going to the Natural History Museum with your kids and seeing a sculpture of Teddy Roosevelt. Can you tell us about that moment again?
So I spend a lot of time at museums. I take my kids very frequently. I didn't go to museums as a kid, and so I'm trying to make up for lost time, maybe. But I went to the Natural History Museum in New York, and as we're approaching the stairs, my son noticed that giant sculpture that's out front, that sculpture that has Teddy Roosevelt sitting on a horse, looking bold and strong and holding the horse with full control. And on the left and the right of him are a Native American and an African American. And as we're walking up to the museum, my son asked the question. He said, "Dad, how come he gets to ride and they have to walk?" And we had a really long conversation about American history, about injustice, and fundamentally for a 9-year-old at the time, what the real issue was very simple, in fact. "Dad, that doesn't look fair." And so after having spent that time with my sons, I decided that I needed to start a body of work that had some way of addressing this injustice that we see again and again in our national monuments.
Mm-hmm. Titus, we're having a national conversation about what to do with Confederate and other monuments with a racist legacy. Boston is currently thinking about whether to rename Faneuil Hall. You've suggested sculptural amendments to these landmarks. Could you explain that to us?
It seems to me that we're having a national conversation about art, but not including artists. It seems quite strange to me that the very people who create these objects that we're debating about are not involved. And so right now we're having a conversation that is primarily binary. Either we keep these sculptures up or we tear them down. I don't think it has to be binary. I don't think it's necessary for it to be binary. I think there is another option, and what I'm proposing is that we actually create amendments. We take those sculptures in the squares that they exist in. We engage our contemporary artists to make new works that stand next to those old works, take the originals off the platforms, put them side by side, and turn those spaces where these new sculptures exist into centers for civic dialogue. Deaccessioning these works is just simply not enough. We can't just take them down and stick them in storage and then all of a sudden believe that our problems are solved. And it's also not enough to just take them down and put up something new. We need to remember where we came from. We need to also remember that we are trying to get someplace different, someplace we have never been before in this country.
And you've said the way to honest art is to wrestle with these questions, right? For the art itself, the art form, to wrestle with its unpleasant past.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So, you know, part of your signature style that gets us to, as you call it, shift our gaze, is to use white paint to cross out white subjects in 18th and 19th century replica paintings, paintings that you've reproduced, and leave only the black subjects, who are often enslaved persons, in the painting. You know, but you say you don't want to eradicate the past or erase history, but instead alter it. How do you perceive the difference in the two?
Well, in terms of the whitewashing that happens in the painting, the important thing to understand about whitewashing a painting and the way that I do it is it's kind of temporary. And what I mean by that is the materials that I put inside of the paint, the linseed oil and the Damar varnish, the nature of oil paint is it becomes more translucent over time. So as I'm whitewashing these figures, they're not permanently removed. What I'm trying to do, as you alluded to, is I'm trying to shift the viewer's gaze for a moment. When I did the TED Talk and I spoke for, you know, 17 minutes or so about the content of the painting and what drew me to the painting, and then I began to make the whitewash on stage, I finished that painting, I stepped off stage, and, you know, the thing that was most shocking to me, is that several people came up to me after and said, you know, I didn't even see that black character until you whited out everything else. Mm-hmm. Because we are trained to view these paintings in a particular way, the hierarchy of the compositional structure is effective. And what it means is these characters that are often in the margins of the painting, we ignore, we miss. Mm-hmm. And this whitewashing just allows us to gaze at them, to consider them just for a moment. And hopefully that shifting allows us to look at those margins, to spend time in the margins in other paintings in the future.
So you haven't used white paint only on white subjects. You know, you also used it on black subjects for your piece called Yet Another Fight for Remembrance that responds to the protests at Ferguson after the death of Michael Brown. And in that painting, two black men hold their hands up and the white paint covers about half of their face. Could you elaborate for us this idea of erasure that you were playing with then? You know, this place of presence and absence existing in the painting at once.
You know, that painting is not only about Ferguson. The challenge with this body of work is it seems to be perceived as being about whatever tragedy is happening at that time. But the reality is it's about all of them. This is not just happening in Ferguson. Obviously, we know this now. It's happening in Philadelphia. It's happening in New York City. It's happening all over our country. And the piece itself, as much as it is about all of those things, is about my personal experience as well. I mean, the piece was started after I was stopped at gunpoint by police officers in New York City accusing me of stealing me and my brother of stealing artwork out of galleries while we had just left my exhibition. For me, in that particular painting, there's this desire to communicate the kind of erasure that you can feel acted against you from other people in society, particularly in that particular case, unfortunately, officers who seem to be trying to erase the value of my citizenship.
Right. I want to go back to that incident. So I read, you know, one of the interviews you did where you spoke about having this art show at a gallery in Chelsea and walking around with your brother in New York City on your way to your art show when two police officers stopped you saying they had been following you for a couple of hours and had noticed you had all gone into several galleries. I wonder if you could tell us what it's like to be lauded in the fine art world, which is still very much a white space, right? And yet also still navigate the world as a black man in your body.
I mean, it's all that I know. I have nothing to compare it to. I can make observations of what it seems like to be in someone else's skin, but those are surely not accurate. What I can say is, as a person who is deeply interested in history, I think it becomes clear for me that there are degrees of citizenship, at least in perception, and at least in the hands of those who often wield the power. And when you are stopped for doing nothing and frisked and thrown up against the wall and have guns pulled on you, it definitely sends the message that there is something about the kind of American that you are that is not equal to other kinds of Americanness.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the language of the forgotten, which will be on view at Massmocha. This piece also shows us Thomas Jefferson, but in a new way. Can you describe it for me?
So this body of work is sort of inspired by that trip with my son to the Natural History Museum. You know, my work is not about demonizing the founding fathers. I don't think there's really any real value in that. But it's also not about deifying them, which I think is the other flaw, problem, paradigm that we exist in. And so in this particular work, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to layer the complex narrative of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Mae Hemings, which is a stand-in, of course, for what we've seen throughout this country for generations. And in this sculpture, you approach a extremely large box that is burned wood, oak on the outside, and it has this silhouette of the profile of Jefferson carved through the wood. And behind that silhouette is a piece of glass with a drawing etched on it of Sally Mae Hemings. And in fact, it's not Sally Mae Hemings. It's a black woman. We read Sally into it, I'll put it that way. And so as you're standing in front of the sculpture, what you see is these two images, this image of this black woman and this image of this white man, and you're struggling to reconcile one or the other, and in fact, you will not be able to. You will have to visually struggle to see them both at the same time. That's the only way the piece can be understood. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is a metaphor for what I'm trying to point to with this national conversation.
Mm-hmm. Titus, one more question. You talk about how painting is a language, that everything in a painting is meaningful. Everything is coded, you know, from the compositional structure to the smallest details in the colors. What's your language on the canvas?
I mean, I think for me, it was about learning to decipher, to decode that language of European painting and revise and restate and reconsider those who never had voices in those paintings. So in fact, I've learned this language in order to say what hasn't been said, in order to focus on what is often buried under layers of fiction.
Artist Titus Kafar joining us from New Haven. Thank you, Titus.
Thank you.
You can find more information on Titus Kafar's newest collection at MassMocha at radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston.